Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from the studios of PCJ Radio International. A return to work by Samoa's police chief remains up in the air. Vivian Egon Kelly had been charged with 265 offenses, but earlier this week they were all dismissed by the Supreme Court due to insufficient evidence. The Samoan Attorney General had hired a private prosecutor from New Zealand, Nigel Hampton, who asked the court to withdraw the charges. He said there were several reasons why the charges should be dismissed, including that the interviews of potential witnesses had not been done to an acceptable standard, and that appropriate legal advice was not sought before the charges were laid. Mr. Kale had a background with the police in Los Angeles, but prior to being hired, he was a civilian residing in Samoa. Don Wiseman spoke to our correspondent in Samoa, Tipi Atagavia, and began by asking him why the government had appointed someone from outside the Samoan police force to do the job.
This is after Cabinet and the government amended the Police Act, where people who had police experience and the rank qualified to apply to the position of the police commissioner. If I can remember, this is the first time the government appointed someone with police experience with that rank that he held in Los Angeles to be the head of the Ministry of Police.
He was brought in as this person with significant experience. There had been these problems in the force. Has he been at loggerheads from day one with some of those other senior officers?
Yes, that's absolutely right, because of the way he administrated the Ministry of Police. And I can remember that after his couple of weeks as a police commissioner, there was word around the town that some police officers have been terminated because of their conduct. And I think from that time, you know, I said to myself, well, this is a good cleanup, because in the past years, there was a number of allegations against the police and how this alleged corruption within the ministry involving senior police officers. But at the end, I think when Mr. Kyle was continuing the cleanup, trying to straighten up things, and then the senior officers were so unhappy. And I think that's why he was very supportive of some of the young police officers in the ministry. And then it was sort of, he has his team of young officers going against the senior officers.
So how's it all going to come out in the end? What likelihood is there of him being able to go back into those offices and pick up where he left off?
Well, there's a lot of rumours, speculations flying around as of yesterday, but still cannot comment on that because we're still waiting for Cabinet's decision.
How do you think he might fit in, though?
Well, as I said yesterday in the interview with Amelia, it's likely that he's going to go back to the ministry to continue his tenure as a police commissioner for his first 3 years contract. But I think the government needs to carefully look at it, the situation right now, to make sure there is no more divisions and no more charges fired against the commissioner.
Egon Kyle, I mean, he had this vast raft of charges against him. How's his frame of mind? Is he bitter about that?
Well, you know, honestly, you know, I was not in the court on Monday because I was sitting in the tribunal of the suspended director of prosecution. But reading newspapers and hearing reports on radio on Monday, he was very excited to go back, looking forward to go back to continue as his job as a police commissioner.
Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama has continued to score highly in the latest polls done by the Tebbutt Research. 78% of the 982 people surveyed over 3 days earlier this month said he was doing a fine or very good job. 40% said he was their preferred prime minister. In a slight drop from last year, but the Fiji First leader remains well ahead of his nearest rival, Seventi Rokobuta, who leads the largest opposition party, Sotopa. A scholar of Fiji politics, Stephen Ratava, told Sally Brown the large number who are undecided on their preferred prime minister is significant with the next election looming.
Something like 30% or so couldn't make up their mind. So that is a very significant number in relation to people changing their mind when the election comes. It looks like Bainimarama is far ahead in terms of the election, and perhaps one of the reasons as well why they want to have the election early, maybe as early as April instead of September. because I think the poll is in their favour at this point in time.
And Sitiveni Rambuka, the leader of the main opposition party, SADELPA, sitting on 11% as preferred leader. What do you think of that?
Yeah, Sitiveni Rambuka is now struggling to mobilise the support within the SADELPA party, because when he came in, it kind of split the party into basically two fragments, one led by Rotemumu and one led by himself. And the party itself has been in a bit of disarray as a result of factionalism within the party itself. He hasn't been able to mobilise the kind of support that one would have expected him, given his high profile, to be able to stamp his authority within the party. Given time, it might go up above 11%, but I think one of the challenges for the SADELPA is being able to sort out the internal differences within the party. Rotemumu herself, she had a lot of respect and support within the party and amongst a lot of Fijians, particularly the more traditional supporters. Rambuka has been out of politics for a long time and is struggling to get his status back. He's been away from politics for 19 years and is trying his best to find a niche in the new political dynamics in Fiji.
We've seen the opposition parties club together in recently in their opposition to the current election supervisor and the Attorney General holding the role of Minister of Elections. Is this pointing towards them actually galvanising and forming a coalition in opposition?
Yeah, the talk of coalition has been there all the time, even before the 2014 election. One of the difficulties in forming coalition is that you have the political parties having different political, ideological, and even personal interests. They have different histories, different, if you like, ideological standpoints. And more so because the Fiji's new electoral system, where there are 50 seats and you have an open single constituency, forming a coalition can be a challenge for political parties, because if they form a coalition before the election, then they have to take the risk of negotiating numbers to reduce the number of candidates which they put forward, which means that they might create tension even within their own parties. So one of the possibilities is to have a coalition after the election. The idea of the parties ganging up together against Fiji First is something that we will see in the next election. And I think the parties may even campaign together and may even do compromises in terms of some of the candidates, supporting certain candidates together.
And what about their across-the-board opposition to the election supervisor?
Yes, the opposition to the supervisor of election has been there even during the last election, 2014. The political parties and some members of the public were not very happy with the appointment of the supervisor of election and his performance. So in terms of perception, one of the things about election is that those involved in the election should be perceived to be independent. And I think because the Attorney General at the moment is also the Secretary of the Fiji First, so people see that as the political linkages between the electoral office and, if you like, the political office. So I think it's very, very important for the electoral process in Fiji in terms of symbolism, in terms of perception of the people. It has to be seen to be independent rather than seen to be politically aligned.
So this could be a thorn in the side as they go forward to the election?
Yes, it will always be there. I think the other political parties will keep raising it. And whether it will change anything or not is another question.
The Cook Islands Health Minister is rejecting suggestions his government's lack of expenditure on health is producing a two-tier system. Instead, Nandi Gassi says the delivery of health care in the Cook Islands is among the best in the region. A predominant New Zealand-based surgeon, George Nagai, has labelled the Cook Islands health budget as a 3.4% of GDP. He says it's a disgrace. But while the minister accepts it's well below World Health Organization requirements of about 5%, he told Joel O'Brien it's the best that can be expected within budgetary constraints.
3.4% is equivalent to about $13 million in the Cook Islands. Given the situation in the Cook Islands, that is all we can run by at this stage. We also have a lot of assistance from the medical specialists from New Zealand. They visit the Cook Islands, so they help provide tertiary care. We also got a very excellent referral system. People that are ill in the Outer Islands, we fly them to Rarotonga. And if they need further medical care, given their serious situation, then we refer them to New Zealand. Even though we might be 3.4%, but in terms of our internal services, particularly the referral services from here to New Zealand, is one of the best.
The surgeon I spoke with, he said that the lack of funding for health in the Cook Islands is leading people to perceive the system there as inadequate. Equipment breaks down, they don't have the right drugs, and that's leading some people to try and get their healthcare overseas in New Zealand and Australia. Do you accept those criticisms?
Not really. I disagree with the surgeon, with respect, because there is no way you can compare the standard of medical care in New Zealand to that of the Cook Islands. We have our constraints, but the Ministry of Health in the Cook Islands is one of the best agency or ministry in the Cook Islands. We have been awarded the Public Service Awards of Excellence for the last 2 years because of the way we address health issues and health delivery in the Cook Islands. We have very less complaints coming from the patients. We set some of the best records. Our level of pregnant mothers dying is zero for the last 9 years. That's another indication. The only people that we refer are those that's beyond our capacity to look after them, and that's why we refer them to New Zealand. But for us, I can assure you as the Minister of Health, the way we provide administration and healthcare delivery in the Cook Islands is one of the best in the region.
This surgeon, talking about what he described as a two-tier system, specifically mentioned that the more advantaged people such as politicians were able to afford to go and access better health care overseas.
Well, I am a politician. I don't get any health care from New Zealand. It is true at some stage that those who seek for further medical care are those who can afford it, and that's true, or those who have health insurance in New Zealand. Understandably, they will go for such service. But for the local people, I can vouch that we have a surgeon over here who is highly qualified, New Zealand trained, doing a very marvelous job. And so as our doctors over here, is highly respected by the community at large.
And just coming back to this figure of 3.4% of GDP is spent on health, would you like to see a higher percentage? And what else is that money going towards that's a bigger priority?
Those are arbitrary figure. The Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Health has got the larger portion of the budget besides internal affairs or welfare. So I would say that rather than looking at the ratio, but the way we appropriate our budget to the two key social policy areas of education and health are, at this stage, appropriate to our situation.
So have you been arguing for more money?
Yes, but then again, you argue for more money provided that it is of utmost priority in our situation. I mean, we have so many priorities. We have patients referred to New Zealand for kidney problems because we don't have any dialysis machine. And there are other areas we need to have more money to have doctors on some of the Outer Islands. But the reality for the Cook Islands is that we have people migrating to New Zealand and to Australia. We have an issue with depopulation. Therefore, if people are sick in the Outer Islands, it's easier for the Ministry of Health to fly them to Rarotonga.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Actors in Australia have refused to voice their support for a campaign to free a performer from Australian detention center on Manus Island. The campaign, which also appeals for the release of a writer and a cartoonist, is being run by the Australian Union for Actors and Journalists, the Media, Entertainment and the Arts Alliance. Several Australian actors have joined the campaign, but as Ben Robinson-Drawbridge reports, none were prepared to comment in the media.
That's the song, recorded in 2014 by prominent Australians, including actors, calling for the release of child refugees detained by Australia on Nauru. But when Australian actors were asked to comment on a 32-year-old performer detained by Australia on Manus Island, none came forward, which the New Zealand actor, Oscar Keightley, agrees is hard to understand. It's a bit strange, really, considering...
It's strange because it's their union, right? If you're unwilling to comment, it's because you're scared about something. But, I mean, I don't know what they'd be scared of. I don't know what the consequences would be.
Oscar Keightley has been outspoken in New Zealand media, decrying Australia's four-year detention of refugees in prison camps on Nauru and Manus Island. Well known for his recent role in the movie Hunt for the Wilder People, Mr. Keightley was happy to voice his support for Merdi Savari, an actor, troubadour, magician and comedian who used to host a popular children's television program in Iran.
I guess I just feel for him as a fellow actor and artist who's chosen to perform in terms of his way of living life and communicating what he's about as a human. And it's just sad to see him caught up in that, really. He sounds amazing. And, gosh, maybe we could even use him in New Zealand.
The Australian author and refugee advocate Arnold Zabel says Mehdi Savari is an Awazi Arab, a persecuted minority in Iran.
In Manus, after the murder of Reza Barati, when the men were in deep despair, he began to perform to lift their spirits. And you know, he suffers from dwarfism. He's only a metre tall. It's very difficult at the best of times to be incarcerated in a detention centre, but for someone of his stature, it's extremely difficult and quite humiliating.
From hospital in Port Moresby, the 32-year-old Mehdi Savari says he's suffering from paralysis.
Currently I'm in Port Moresby, where after 4 years I have finally saved enough money to buy myself a wheelchair. I'm here because of my eye infection and serious gastric problems for which I take daily medication. The emotional trauma I've experienced and the physical hardships I've endured living on Manus Island have resulted in the breakdown of my mental health and are the reason why I am in this situation in Port Moresby.
The campaign also appeals for the release of the Kurdish journalist Behruz Buchani and the award-winning cartoonist from Iran known as Eaton Fish. Arnold Zabel says Mr. Buchani is working tirelessly to expose human rights violations perpetrated by Australia.
He's bearing witness in many forms. He's known in the camp as the reporter. He's working up to 18 hours a day, sending out articles and features that are published both internationally and in the Australian press. Huffington Post, even New York Times recently had a video diary of his. So he's tireless in his work and, as a result, he's valued by the international journalistic community.
The Guardian cartoonist Andrew Marlton, known as First Dog on the Moon, says Eaton Fish would be an asset to Australia.
He's got a very wry way of looking at the world and he's got a perspective that not many other people do, considering where he's come from and what he's seen. And, you know, getting him here and getting him into an art school and getting him working as a cartoonist is in everybody's best interest.
Oscar Keightley says the three men could make Australia a better country.
They fled a place because of what they did for a job, and they're able to write about these things and also have a perspective that journalists and cartoonists and even actors in Australia don't have, because they come from countries that were torn apart. You know, they can absolutely add to the storytelling that stops that sort of thing from spreading.
Mr. Keightley says all the refugees detained offshore have something to offer Australia. This has been Robinson Drawbridge.
A group is waiting to bring dialysis treatment for kidney disease sufferers to Tonga, says government inaction is stalling the plans. Dialysis treatment is not available in Tonga, although reports say there are about 200 people that have been diagnosed with chronic kidney failure each year, and about a third of them need such treatment. Koro Vakauta reports.
In the past, the government has said it doesn't have the budget to help patients, as a dialysis machine costs up to $2.3 million. The Tonga Dialysis Foundation president, Siosaya Moihau, says they submitted a proposal to government over a year ago to partner with a Fiji company to open a dialysis clinic, but have not heard back.
I think it's all about an attitude problem. We already demonstrated to them we can do the whole thing ourselves with our donors and our partners. It seems like that they still restrict to some sort of thing which we don't understand.
Mr. Moihau says the Mormon Church is one of several donors who can finance the project, but wants a letter of approval and support from the government before releasing funds. But the government says it's aiming to address renal failure and kidney disease by managing diabetes first. The Ministry of Health CEO Siali Akaola says because the majority of kidney disease cases develop from diabetes, the government is focused on prevention.
That's the focus, to promote good healthy living so that people do not develop diabetes in the first place. And the second one, of course, if you have diabetes, then to aggressively manage it as best as we can. It's been shown that if you aggressively manage diabetes to a very good level, you will never develop renal disease. We've had diabetics who are well managed. They live healthy lives even into their 70s and 80s.
Dr. Siali Akaola says in principle the government would support a private dialysis facility, but the Tonga Dialysis Foundation still waiting for a letter from government. A former international rugby player who says he's stranded overseas because of kidney disease has added his voice to the calls for dialysis treatment to be provided in the kingdom. 27-year-old Sione Vaiamuonga played for Tonga at the 2011 Rugby World Cup and then secured a contract to play in Romania. However, during his first season, he was diagnosed with kidney disease in 2014 and has been in Romania since, receiving the necessary dialysis treatment that's not available in Tonga. I spoke to Mr. Vaiamuonga on an almost inaudible line from the Eastern European country and private messenger. His words are voiced over.
For me, I don't have diabetes. The doctor here doesn't know how or why I have kidney failure. They don't find the reason why, but they just said my kidney's not working anymore. I know Tonga have not approved dialysis in Tonga because of all the expenses, but I know for sure not only us rugby players are having kidney failure. I'm sure there's lots of people in Tonga that have it. They do need help, as lucky for us, we have been struggling in a place where we can get help. If we were in Tonga, I don't know what's going to happen.
The TDF says there are hundreds of people waiting for dialysis in Tonga. Mr. Vaiamuonga says the government needs to look after its people. In the meantime, Mr. Vaiamuonga says he's hoping for a transplant so he can one day return to Tonga to be with his parents, who he hasn't seen in 3 years.
I am staying here
because it is the only option for me now. For me, I always want to move from here, someplace close to Tonga, but I remain because I need treatment, but I would love to go back to Tonga.
The Tongan government says up to 17% of the population is diabetic, but there's no current data on kidney disease available. This is Korovaka Uta.
Within months, Tonga will have a new postal system where every house will have an address consisting of three random words. Like much of the Pacific, Tonga really doesn't have a formal addressing system, which can make things difficult for a country's mail deliverers. The chief executive of Tonga Post, Sififia Poma, says the organization has been looking for a solution for years and has now teamed up with a British company, What Three Words. Mr. Pomana told Jamie Tahanaha that under the new program, over the next few months, all of Tonga will be divided into 9 square meter sections, which will be assigned with a combination of three words.
We had started with government to partner in getting an addressing system, but we find that has been very, you know, time-consuming, cost a lot, actually, when we did this back in 2012. And so we just parked it and, you know, looked around for options that will, you know, be feasible and that will help, particularly for the purpose of us here at Tonga Post. And when we came across What Three Words, we thought, brilliant, this is the solution that we really need right now. It's ready, it's available, and it's something that we could just roll out.
Because Tonga's like a lot of Pacific countries where addresses, street numbers, street names even aren't really a thing.
Well, we're badly addressed, and you know, we rely on directions. As you know, it's more like, okay, if you want to find my house, just come to this particular village, look for the green mango tree, if it's still green, and you'll turn left, and you'll see, you know, shack, and talk to the guy there. He'll show you where my house is, probably 3 blocks down. And for us in the post, to deliver mail, that just makes it really, really tough. And particularly now, in a time where people, they really want their mail right now. So a quick way to do that is to really pinpoint where the location is and pinpoint that accurately, not just by directions.
So how exactly does it work? It's a three-word system, isn't it? Three random words that will become your address.
Yes, it's driven by technology. It's by a smart device and on an app that's created by What Three Words. That's how you pinpoint this particular address, that three-word. It works by a grid that's 3 meters 3 meters, and, you know, according to GPS. So for us, being in Tongariro, we don't have formal addresses. We go by villages, roughly, and by, you know, by the island island group they're in. But to have this will help us. Actually, first is to pinpoint the delivery point. We know exactly the place to be delivering it to. But to know that is through this campaign where we will be rolling out to people. Actually, we would visit homes, starting with a pilot that we're doing with our P.O. Box customers. So we'll visit their homes and give them their three-word address. It's a random three words, but at least for us at the post, we will know exactly where people are.
Okay, so say I'm sitting here in central Wellington and want to post you in Nuku'alofa a letter. What would I be writing on that envelope then?
So part of the plan is we're not to replace the current way that people have been addressing mail to Tonga. For example, address a letter to Tonga would be just a name, village, the island group in Tonga. So what we're planning is to just keep that, but at the bottom, add that random three words. And when it gets to us, it helps for our guys to really accurately read the right three words and know exactly where these people are.
And so when does this all kick off? You've got an awareness campaign just getting underway. When do you hope
That's
to have this in place?
So yes, we're going to spend the rest of February for the campaign, and come March, that's when we start piloting with our PO Box customers.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also find us on Stitcher Smart Radio. Just go to the App Store and download the app for your phone. And it's not, of course, just for Focus Asia Pacific, but other PCJ programs as well. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until then, so long, and take care.